is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of the CoDiscovery podcast with me, Abigail Acton. Humanity is running an ecological Ponzi scheme in which society robs nature and future generations to pay for boosting incomes in the short term. One of many stark warnings about our impact on the environment around us, this one issued by a group of leading scientists in their paper Understanding the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future, published in Frontiers in Conservation Science. They go on to add that 3/4 of new infectious diseases result from human-animal interactions. Much of the environmental degradation is occurring in biodiversity hotspots, where pathogen diversity is also highest, but where institutional capacity is weakest, further increasing the risk of pathogen release and spread. So how does biodiversity depend on geography? What impact is the illegal trade in wildlife having on the communities that are involved and on targeted species? What can be done to preserve areas? Do protected areas protect? Here to talk through these and other issues their research has examined are our three guests, whose work was funded under the EU's Horizon 2020 programme. Pedro Cardoso, curator at the Finnish Museum of Natural History, University of Helsinki, whose focus includes biogeography, conservation and functional ecology, often using islands and caves as model systems. Dr. Cardoso was supervising Nuria Macias, a Marie Curie fellow, working on the BioDiv Island CONT project. Pedro, welcome.
Hello, Abigail, and thanks for the invitation.
Rosaline Duffy, Professor of International Politics at Sheffield University, whose focus includes global governance, environmental politics, and ecotourism in developing states. Professor Duffy was the coordinator of the BioSec project. Welcome, Rosaline.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Our great pleasure. And Jonas Geldman, based at the Centre for Macroecology, Evolution and Climate at the University of Copenhagen, who is interested in seeing how pressure, as measured by remote sensed data, combined with how managers of protected areas perceive threats, can shine a light on human impact on biodiversity. Dr. Geldman was involved in the Pressure Project. Welcome, Jonas.
Thank you very much, and hello, everyone.
Let's get to it. Professor Cardoso, I have a couple of questions that I would like to ask to you, and then perhaps we could talk in an open discussion where the other guests can maybe ask questions also. So my first question for you, concerning the nature of biodiversity on islands as opposed to continental land masses, I'm curious to know what functional traits, such as those relating to dispersal capacity, reproduction, trophic ecology, are associated with high diversification rates within and across island systems. If you could break those ideas down for us, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, probably the main trait that we immediately think about is dispersal ability. Bad dispersers just don't reach the islands. They don't have the capacity to reach at least that's oceanic islands, which are can be hundreds or thousands of kilometers from the nearest landmass. Good dispersers often are too good dispersers. So they reach the islands, but then there's still some genetic flux between populations in the islands. So there won't be speciation in significant numbers on the islands. So there is this ideal dispersal capacity that organisms must have to give rise to numerous species. But what's curious is that many species often lose their ability to disperse, because once you are on an island, if you basically try to fly too far or to navigate too far, then you'll be lost at sea. So many times insular species, they just lose the ability to disperse far, or maybe they just don't need to disperse anymore if they don't find predators, for example, like the dodo is a very famous example. They were not able to move that fast, and of course there are also other traits that might have a role in this. You can think, for example, about the hunting mode. The species, once they reach an island, if they find, let's say, empty niches, they might find ways to occupy those niches. So they might find prey that they did not find when on the mainland. So they will.
I'm just curious. Excuse me. I'm curious to know some examples of actual animals that you could think of. The hunting mode idea is interesting.
Yes, about the hunting mode. In fact, we are studying spiders in the Micronesian Islands, in Madeira, the Canary Islands, and the Azores. We have just published a number of described a number of new species from a single small island with 10 square kilometers. In this small island, we have found 5 new species for science of just one genus of spider, these woodlouse spiders. And each one differs a bit in their body size and their color and their mouth parts, so adapting to different conditions, to different prey. And this only in 10 square kilometers you find these many species adapted to small variations what they do in this island.
And that concentration of the number of species in such a small area, is that a function of the fact that it is a small area? I mean, I would have thought that they'd squeeze each other out, but you're saying they're adapted to different prey.
Yeah, exactly. What happens that they probably we did not study this specifically, but they probably are adapted to different prey, to different microhabitats. Sometimes they occupy different places in this small island. So yeah, this allows them to occupy the same space.
It sounds as if they are relatively vulnerable, which leads me to my next question, really. I'm wondering if at all, do island biotas differ from continental biotas in their response to global change and the impact of human activity, such as territory encroachment or illegal trade? Are they more vulnerable? Can you think maybe of an example of an island species that maybe is hit hard by human activity?
Intrinsically, they are not more vulnerable. They respond basically the same way as mainland species. But of course, being on islands, they are in very specific conditions. They are isolated, right? So this is what really puts them in higher danger on average than mainland species. So they have limited space to move. So if, for example, as a consequence of global warming, they must move northwards, they won't be able to do it many times. So they might move upwards in altitude, but not northwards. If there is habitat destruction, they won't be able to escape it as easily as a species on the mainland. There are a few threats which are more pervasive on islands, like invasive species. These are a serious concern, mainly on islands. It's very, very common that some species are introduced by men and they outcompete or predate on the native species, and this is particularly important for islands. So, for example, I was talking about these woodlouse spiders. In fact, all of these species that we have found are endangered. They are very limited, and many of them, not only in this small islet, but also other islets around in Madeira and the Azores and the Canary Islands, are threatened by invasive species of the same genus that came from the mainland. This is a big problem for almost all of these species, and some of them are only surviving in a few hectares. And many cases, we think it's because of this invasive from the mainland.
Mm.
And I can also give you the example of the Desertus wolf spider, which is one of the largest spiders in Europe, lives in less than 1 square kilometer, although it's a pretty big spider. But it is threatened by an invasive plant, which has really, let's say, aggressive roots, which fill all the empty spaces on the soil that the spider needs to take refuge from predators and from cication.
That's a fantastic example, because often when we think of invasive species, we sometimes think, well, I personally think of species coming in that are basically going to predate upon the animal concerned, or, for example, attack the animal at a certain point of its life cycle, like that hideous thing about the rats on one of the islands that feed on the albatross eggs and the young albatross, things like that. The idea of encroachment of habitat through something like roots is interesting. It just shows you how tightly it is all connected. Very interesting. Rosaline, Jonas, do you have any questions that you would like to put to Pedro, because he's raised some interesting points, I think.
Yeah, one thing that came to mind, sort of coming from a conservation angle, looking at protected areas, we're often focusing a lot on the threatened and the rare species. And I wondered, with sort of some of the traits that you were describing in terms of what make a good disperser, to what extent sort of how the abundance or the commonness or the rareness of a species in the source population from whatever continent they're coming in plays a role in how likely they are to actually make it out to islands.
Yeah, well, just by chance, of course, if a species is quite common, there are many more chances that it will reach the an island, right? And I think that's the main point.
How frequently is it the case that actually the species are brought in by human activity? I mean, might it be that certain species like rats and cats get around more easily because they are so closely allied to human activity?
Yeah, if you think about invasive species, yeah, of course, species that are associated with man, they have much higher probabilities of reaching the islands. We can think, about mice and cats, and of course, those that are introduced by man on purpose, like rabbits and goats, which was very common thing to do, to release rabbits and goats on some of the islands, so that when you return to the island — this was in the 15th and 16th century — when we return to the island, already have food there, right? So these were on purpose, others are accidental.
Pedro, can you think of some examples of species that are really almost only found in a certain island, on a certain island, or maybe an archipelago, that are being particularly threatened by human activity at the moment?
Thinking about spiders again, it's my expertise, the group that I know more about. There are a few cases of some species that are restricted to islands, and which are a favorite of traffic and poachers. So one example are the Poikilotheria, the tarantulas from Sri Lanka, which are really famous in the trade, and in fact they were included in CITES just recently because of the perils caused by trade. So this is one of the examples, and probably there are more. It's not a question of being island species, just that it happens that these large and nice species to have as a pet are on an island, in this case Sri Lanka.
Rosaline, I know your interest is in the illegal trade in wildlife and wildlife crimes. The example that Pedro gives about the tarantulas is just one, I'm sure. Can you think of any other examples where human activity of this nature is having an impact on population numbers of animals on islands?
Certainly. I mean, I can think of the radiated tortoise from Madagascar as a really good example, because that's one that's desired by collectors. And radiated tortoises in Madagascar have really suffered substantially from the illegal wildlife trade. So that's certainly one really good example of an island species that's impacted negatively by illegal wildlife trading.
Right. And Rosaline, the term illegal trade in animals, that's the term. So by definition, of course, it's a crime. But in practice, what are the problems with viewing it as a crime and a security threat? And how does that change conservation practice?
Yeah, again, that's a really good question. And it does seem to make intuitive sense that, you know, if something's illegal, then of course it's a crime and we should have a response that's anchored in law enforcement, crime and policing. But that's really blunt. So we need to, again, look at the ideas behind calling it a crime or referring to it as a crime. Some of the legal arrangements that were first put in place by British colonisers in Africa is a really good example of that. So it's no wonder that these communities may find wildlife laws as unjust. But I think certainly in the last 10 years, the interest from global policymakers is because there's a growing agreement that wildlife losses, some of which are produced by illegal wildlife trade, produce a convergence of threats to ecosystems, geopolitical stability, national security, human health and well-being, and for future generations. And so in our research projects, you know, we have kind of unpicked, you know, what are the problems with thinking of it as a wildlife crime. There was a point in time not too long ago when one referred to a wildlife crime, it meant things like hare coursing or badger baiting. It didn't refer to the illegal wildlife trade, but that's changed since the spikes in poaching of elephants and rhinos, particularly from around about 2008. And I think part of the explanation is that conservation NGOs need to compete for funds. It's a highly competitive environment, and they've found that they can amplify their messages, drive attention and funding their way by linking together conservation and security concerns. And so there's been this real expansion in the amount of funding available for projects that tackle illegal wildlife trade. So that's one set of explanations.
If I could just ask you, talking about security, I know you're, I mean, security, of course, is a wide word and covers many different types of threats. But given the situation we all find ourselves in this pandemic, of course, the one immediate idea is the notion of security with regards to pathogens. How does the notion of environmental crime overlap with human health and the transference of pathogens here?
Yeah, so there have been, since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, there have been calls in the NGO community and from states for very forceful action to call a halt to the illegal wildlife trade as a potential place where new pathogens can arise, where a virus can jump species because of the kind of close proximity of species to humans in wildlife markets. And those involved in tackling the illegal wildlife trade have for a very long time pointed to the risks of zoonosis, that's the transmission of disease from non-human animals to humans. And the biosecurity risks are very clear. Deadly viruses that we've seen in the past, like Ebola, Lassa, Marburg, and COVID-19, are all zoonotic diseases that originated in wildlife. And it may be the wildlife trade that has provided an opportunity for the virus to jump. But the problem with that is a bit like, you know, the problems with calling wildlife trade a security issue is that making the link with the wildlife trade, that's one link and that's important. And that's led to calls for permanent bans on wildlife markets. But other experts involved in looking at illegal wildlife trade and at sustainable livelihoods have cautioned against these kinds of calls for blanket bans because they could be really inimical to the livelihoods of some of the world's poorest people and could have counterproductive conservation outcomes for some species that are kind of sustainably traded. So if you think of wild meat consumption and trade, you know, if you instantly ban that or put in an international ban, then unless you put in place resources and alternatives for people who rely on that trade to meet their everyday needs, then that ban won't work. Or if it does work, then it will have really devastating consequences for some of the world's poorest people.
Right. When we consider the risks of zoonosis and transference of pathogens, often there are calls to close down wildlife meat markets. Could you explain why that isn't necessarily a good idea? What are the concomitant risks there?
Yeah, well, one of the problems is that some of the world's most marginalised and poorest people are reliant on the wildlife trade to make ends meet, either for their own consumption or that they sell into wildlife markets. And so if you immediately ban wildlife markets, then you don't put in place something to replace that source of income or to replace that source of protein for those communities, then the impact of those bans is that it has a really devastating impact on some of the world's most vulnerable and marginalised people. And we do see that if new laws are enacted to make wildlife trade illegal, that it can drive trades underground.
Excellent. Thank you. That's very clear and also very interesting. Can I ask if you have questions for the other guests, for Pedro or for Jonas? Or Jonas, Pedro, would you have any questions for Rosaline?
Yeah, I have a question for Pedro, which is about, you know, the sort of identification of humanity or impacts from humanity on island species. And I wondered if you could just unpick a little bit what you mean as the main drivers of sort of human impacts on these species. What are the main human impacts?
There is no real ranking of the impacts, but there is more or less of an agreement that habitat loss is the main cause for the loss of species either on mainland or on the islands. And then, as I mentioned already, invasive species are particularly important on islands, besides all the usual suspects like climate change.
Jonas, yes, so do you have a question for Pedro or for Rosaline?
Yeah, I had one for Rosaline. Are there any particular sort of markers or indicators of what makes a successful, sustainable, harvested or hunted population?
So there are indicators. So for each species that's listed under the CITES Convention, states have to have a list of indicators that show that the trade in the species doesn't have a detrimental impact on that species' long-term survival. And so each country has to provide these indicators. And of course, the indicators are subject to discussion and controversy amongst different interest groups. Some groups don't want trade in particular species at all, regardless of whether it's sustainable or not. And some believe that it's really important to allow sustainable trade to continue.
Thank you. That's interesting. Jonas, does that answer what you were thinking? Question?
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's great, because I'd like to actually turn to you now, Jonas, because we're talking here now, obviously, about the threats to wildlife through wildlife crimes. And I know that you're very interested in protected areas and conservation areas and whether they work or not. In order to know if protected areas can be an effective response to human encroachment, we do need to know if they work. So how can we tell? How do you assess the impact of labelling an area, a wildlife sanctuary or a protected area, on conservation itself?
Yeah, so I think there's three or maybe even four key challenges when we try to understand if protected areas are effective. And the first one is probably that protected areas, while sort of a broad title, usually are designated for quite specific objectives. So it's understanding why are we actually designating a particular area? What is the species? What are the ecosystems? Or what are the features that we're actually interested in? The other aspect is that protected areas are not located randomly in the landscape. And what we've seen what we see generally is that protected areas are often located in areas that are remote, so they're far from people and far from the pressures that actually would affect them. So if you just look at whether they are doing better than non-protected areas without accounting for this, you might find that they actually are, but that the areas would have been doing that or would have been effective regardless of whether they were protected or not, simply because they are out of harm's way. So understanding quite explicitly what are the biases in location and integrating that in what we generally call a counterfactual analysis, trying to find a similar location to the protected areas, but one that is not protected is key. And then I guess a third one is a lot of what we do analysis-wise with protected areas is retrospective. We're looking at an established network of protected areas. Currently, we have more than 230,000 protected areas across the world. And we can only really understand them. We can't sort of set up these ideal experimental setups for how we would want to do it, because we can't just designate protected areas for the testing of whether they work. So that introduces quite a bit of challenge as well. And then I guess a fourth sort of associated aspect is that we are actually not only interested in understanding whether they are effective, but also why. So understanding what are the management interventions, what are the dialogues with local stakeholders, what are the features that sort of sets the protected areas apart that actually makes an impact on the protected status.
I find interesting the idea, as you say, it seems so logical that some places work as protected areas just because they are so inaccessible and it's their own geographical location that's making them protected anyway. I'm thinking of St Kilda, for example, off Scotland in the Hebrides, which I visited, which was an amazing site.
Yeah.
In the middle of absolutely the Atlantic Ocean, so very protected. Interesting.
Yeah, and one of the classic examples of this is Mount Egmont in New Zealand, which is sort of it's a mountain that is protected. And when you just look at it from sort of a satellite image, you will see that following almost perfectly the boundaries of the protected areas, you have forest. And outside the protected areas, all of the forest is lost. And it's very easy to think, well, that's clearly an effective protected area, when in reality, it's just a very steep mountain where none of the conventional used foresting tools are cost effectively able to actually cut down the forest there. So what you have is in effect just the remains of unproductive land or what couldn't be utilized by the foresters.
No, that is a very neat example. It must almost look like a haircut where it just like suddenly becomes no longer financially viable to bother. So they just go away and leave it alone. And yes, absolutely. Looking at that, one would think it was working as a protected area. Very interesting. And Pedro, thinking about what we were talking about, island species visiting and going back to my point about visiting St Kilda, we had to land in zodiacs. So we had to land in rubber zodiacs because they were worried about rats being introduced. So that's interesting as a little aside there. Jonas, with regards to what you were just saying, and so what are you actually finding? Are you finding that protected areas to a great extent are effective? What causes some not to be? What causes some to be? And is there anything we can do to make those that perhaps aren't working so well work better? What are you finding?
I think it's important to start out by saying that if there's a place sort of in international policy where we have been quite successful, it's in establishing protected areas. As I said, we now have about 230,000, if not already more. Those numbers are a few days old. And they cover almost 17% of the global terrestrial area and almost 8% of the oceans. So we've created an enormous amount of protected areas. And that obviously also leads to a huge variability in what we see in the protected areas. We see that generally some of the most iconic and most important protected areas, some of those established for the longest and some of those established in really some of the hotspots of biodiversity, they are effective. But what we also see is that this sort of race to establish more and more protected areas have actually led to, on average, protected areas are not effective. And this is even against the counterfactual. So this is not just that they are not doing worse than areas that are similar to these and not protected. And that is a bit surprising and a bit...
And do we have any reasons for why? Can you give us some examples of why that might be?
So also there's a high diversity of reasons. What we generally see in some of these cases are that governments just establish protected areas because they have to, because of international conventions, but they don't really put in place any management structures. They don't fund them very well. So that's what we generally tend to call paper parks. What we're also seeing is, so because there's a signature on a piece of paper somewhere in the ministry, but you don't really have anything going on the ground. What we also seem to see, and this is, I have to say, something we speculate because we don't have the data to actually investigate this, is that in some cases, you have very good local management of the resources by local communities who have lived in the areas and used the areas for very long. But as soon as a government comes in and actually establishes now, says this is a protected area, it takes away the ownership and it takes away the rights of the local people, which makes them potentially care less about the area. It also, for sort of more illegal activities such as deforestation or agricultural expansion, it suddenly provides the bigger companies with an easier route to find out who who do you need to talk to actually start activities? Suddenly you have to go to the ministry instead of talking to local stakeholders. And I think that's some of the cases where we see that actually the establishment of the protected area leads to a negative impact, because prior to protection, they were actually working relatively well. And this just de facto establishment of protection leads to some of them suddenly being corrupted and working worse than before protection.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'd like to see if I could just ask you each to give me a relatively brief, tight response to a question that I'll put to you in turn this time. So, Pedro, coming back to you, what do you feel would be the one thing that you would like to see change in the next decade when it comes to biodiversity and what happens on islands?
Yeah, not only on islands, but this is a something for every kind of setting, but take biodiversity seriously. Basically, I think we have already realized how important it is to mitigate climate change, biodiversity protection is somehow lagging behind, and it is it affects us as humans, arguably even more than climate change. Mm,
thank you, Pedro. Rosaline, going back then to the question, with regards to your area of interest and research, what would you like to see in the next 10 years happen?
Yeah, so one thing I'd really like to see change is approaching the illegal wildlife trade as an issue of global inequality, that demand itself is driven by the wealthy world and that supply is often provided by marginalised and vulnerable communities. And I think there's sometimes an almost, you know, it's a sort of a neglect of understanding and tackling capitalist logics and a global economy that's based around growth in the conservation community as a driver of wider forms of environmental problems as well. So I think such an approach would produce very different solutions from the conservation community. So there would be more focus on demand reduction in wealthy communities, more focus on supporting and meeting the aspirations and desires of people living with wildlife. And that really does need to go beyond offering people a few jobs as rangers or in the tourism industry in the local eco lodge if you declare a protected area and then exclude them from gaining any kinds of access to the resources within that area. So instead, we need to ask those communities, what do you want? What do you need to live a good life? And I think that would have a much better chance of preventing people from entering the poaching economy.
Right. Basically, more feeling more invested on the ground. Because, yeah. Jonas, coming to you now, and with regards to your area of interest and research, may I ask you what you would like to see over the next decade?
Yeah, so I think for protected areas, the last decade or even the last two decades have been very much focused on increasing coverage, on establishing more protected areas. And I think for the next decade, what we really need is focus on quality, focus on how do we ensure that the existing protected areas are actually benefiting biodiversity and the people living in and around them? And I think that involves much closer collaboration and cooperation with the local communities in and around them, but also to a large extent, at an increased funding. We are seeing a large funding deficit in what countries are committing to their protected area networks.
Right. Going back to what you were saying about paper parks. Yes, it's all very well talking about it, but you actually have to make it happen on the ground. Well, thank you very much, all of you, for such an interesting discussion. I think it's revealed concepts and ideas that people may not have considered before. Certainly, it's revealed some concepts that I haven't thought of before. I'm still fascinated by the notion of the plant roots taking up the space that's needed by the spiders. I'd never thought of that. It's very interesting. For all of you who have been listening, thank you very much for having downloaded this episode of Core Discovery Podcast. I do hope you enjoyed it. Find out what other projects funded by the EU are working on in this area by taking a look at issue 92 of the Research EU magazine, Biodiversity, A New Deal for Nature, available on the Cordis website, cordis.europa.eu. News articles, daily features setting out the results of groundbreaking research, a magazine that explores the hottest new discoveries, and results packs that bring together findings by subject. All these are available at the Cordis website, and if you are a researcher interested in applying for EU support, the site can show you what's being done in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you, so drop us a line using editorial@cordis.europa.eu. I'm looking forward to sharing the interesting findings of our next guest with you next month, when the subject will be the future of aviation. The sector's taken a huge hit over the last year. Where to now? Until next time.